Okay, Marshall, please call the next case.
Now calling A23-0455, Ming Lei Lu, respondent versus Mohammed Sabri, appellant, Mona Sabri et al. Defendants.
Good morning. I'll just repeat a little bit of the information that I shared at the beginning of our calendar today. I'm Judge Wheelock. I'm sitting with Judges Bratfold and Smith. And we have two counsel here today. When you move to the podium, feel free to adjust that up and down. As you probably know, you'll each have 15 minutes, including an additional 5 minutes for appellant for rebuttal. We are recording these arguments. The audio will be available in about 24 hours on the Judicial Branch website. So when you begin, please say your name and identify the client you represent clearly, and let us know if there's any pronunciations or pronouns we should be aware of. So the clock needs to be reset to 15, and once that happens, counsel for appellant, feel free to begin.
Good morning, Your Honors. Justice Lindell for the appellant, Mohammed Sabri. So this was a case brought to recover damages arising from alleged fraud, breach of contract, and unjust enrichment, put broadly. This appeal addresses the calculation of prejudgment interest on the damages that were awarded to the respondent at trial by the jury, which interest was then calculated by the district court under Minnesota Statute 334.01. We believe the district court erred and should have calculated prejudgment interest under Section 549.09. In this case, the respondent was an investor who invested $553,000 into appellant's Latino market project. The lawsuit alleged that the appellant misappropriated or misapplied the investment monies instead of using them to advance the Latino market project the way that they had agreed the monies would be applied. Now, it's important to note that the party's agreement was to use the investment money for Latino market. This was not a loan made by the respondent to the appellant. There were no repayment terms in the contract. This was an investment, not a loan. The issues that went to trial were liability and damages. The jury had to answer whether the appellant was liable to the respondent under any of the asserted claims. So, was there a breach of contract? Was there securities fraud? Was there common law fraud? Was there unjust enrichment? They had to, the jury had to decide the damages. What were the amounts of the damages that were suffered by the respondent? Both of those issues went to the jury. One issue the jury did not have to address was the date that respondents' claims arose. And that is because there was a stipulation between the parties before trial that acknowledged there was a dispute over which statute would govern the calculation of prejudgment interest, and there was a dispute over the dates that the claims arose. And that's important because it's necessary for purposes of the prejudgment interest calculation. The parties stipulated to the dates that the claims arose in case Section 334.01 applied, and they also stipulated as to the date that either written notice of the claim or the filing of the claim happened in case Section 549.09 was found to apply. And the parties agreed to remove instructions and questions regarding interest from the jury instructions and the special verdict form, thus leaving the question of which statute applied to the interest calculation to the district court. At trial, the parties put on extensive testimony and evidence regarding the disposition of respondents' investment monies and the expenditures that the appellant allegedly made to benefit the Latino market project. So as I said, the jury was asked, you know, was there fraud, was there a breach of contract, and if so, what were the damages? So you had evidence that was put on, the respondent putting on evidence and arguing none of this money was used the way that I wanted it to be. You know, I was investing into this project. They took the money. They didn't use it for the project. I'm out my entire $553,000. And the appellant provided evidence and argued that at least some of the monies were used, for example, to build out space for the Latino market. The appellant, you know, evidence and testimony, documentary and testimony evidence, that some of the monies had been used.
Counsel, when you have a breach, like here are the breach of contract and the fraudulent transfer claims, and the date that was ultimately used, I mean, that statute that was applied was 334, and then it dates it to when the payments were made, right, by the plaintiff in this case. What it seems to me your argument is, as long as a defendant was defending against breach of contract or fraud by arguing, even on damages, even if the jury rejects that, as long as they were, challenging that, it can't be ascertainable. And that seems to kind of swallow up a lot in the ascertainable world. You know, what's that? Are damages ascertainable only? It can't be only if the defendant agrees to liability, right?
Of course not.
Right? Okay, so then it's just the damages, right, that we need to be looking at. And so if the defendant disagrees, you know, and says, no, you got some value out of this, and the jury says, yeah, I don't think so.
That's exactly the dispute.
Why? So as long as, what do they have to, do damages have to be stipulated to for it to be ascertainable? Give me an ascertainable case under contract.
You failed to repay a loan. There's an amortization schedule attached to the loan. What payments did you fail to make? We have a document. It says, this is what you owe. That's easy. That's ascertainable.
And how about fraud?
I don't know how. It depends on the fraud, right? If the dispute was whether or not you lied, not whether or not you used the money appropriately.
And
that's where I'm not following, Your Honor. I think law is clear.
Well, the fraud, I guess, is you pay me money and I will do X with it.
Right.
And then they proved up, presumably, that defendant didn't do X with it.
That's the whole point.
You're saying that that's not ascertainable because there was a defense that they did something with it?
Well, correct. I mean, you have liquidated damages, right? We have a contract that says if you fail to do X, Y, and Z, then you pay me, you know, this amount of money. That's ascertainable. You've got things like a loan or, for example, like an insurance policy, breach of an insurance policy. Here's how much it costs me to get my roof replaced. Insurer, pay my contractor. Here's the bill. Here's the invoice, $101,000 to get my roof done. That's a breach of contract claim. What are the damages? Readily ascertainable. Here's the amount that you're supposed to pay under the insurance contract. Now, if the insurer said, wait a minute, we cut you like 6 checks, and we're pretty sure you cashed them. And then the person says, well, no, I didn't get those checks. Well, they were cashed. Okay, now we have a dispute. Was money, right? Did the money change hands, and was it used for? Was it given to somebody who used it for what it was appropriately supposed to be done? And if there's a valid factual dispute regarding who got the money and what it was used for in that insurance policy example, then you'd have to go to a jury to figure it out. They'd have to answer a factual question. And if there isn't a dispute about that, then you would have a summary judgment motion, or you'd have motions in limine, and you'd have objections to the evidence. You'd come in and go,
wait a
minute.
But what about that makes it not readily ascertainable? I think that's the point we're trying to get to.
So the question is whether or not we have, if the question of how much money was actually used for the project goes to the jury, which it did here, then it's not readily ascertainable because there was evidence and arguments. They said, listen, we spent money on planning out the space. We hired an architect and paid the architect. That was part of this project. They said that they spent, like, I think legal, and page 5 of our opening brief has all the cites to the record where they went in detail with, here's our evidence that we used portions of this money appropriately, and thus those should not be counted as damages against us. Right? So it was a disputed question. If there wasn't a dispute about the amount, then it should have been a motion for summary judgment, could have been a motion in limine to preclude arguments and evidence intended to change, you know, to go to the question of damages, et cetera. But the case law is clear, right? We've got the Trapp and we've got Hoganson, and they say, if the jury is asked to determine the amount of damages, then that's not readily ascertainable. And it goes right to the heart of why they do that.
Counsel, let me stop you there. So Trapp and Hoganson, you think, are the best cases in support of your position, your understanding or argument about what's readily ascertainable?
I do think that those are both.
Okay.
Yeah.
So the language that I see in Hoganson is, has to do with jury discretion?
Yes.
Right? Is that what you're relying on?
I'm actually relying on the entirety of both of those cases, which I think clearly express that when damages are disputed, there's a fact question about the amount of damages, and it goes to the jury, and the jury is asked to determine, as they were in this case, what amount, if any, what amount between zero and 100% are the damages that were incurred by the plaintiff? That's what those cases say. That's not readily ascertainable.
So for a loan case, you're saying it is readily ascertainable if there's a default on a loan, and a jury is never asked then what damages would be in such a case?
Well, I do a lot of insurance cases. Mm-hmm. We often have no disputes there with regard to what is the amount at stake. You know, you may have a coverage dispute, but the amount is the amount that the contractor handed a bill and said, okay, I have fixed all the water damage. And if there's a portion of that bill that the insurance company says, that wasn't water damage, that was already there, mm-hmm. those ordinary wear and tear. So there's $10,000, right, that's ordinary wear and tear. Well, you still have a question of, that's not a disputed amount, because we all agree how much money was incurred to pay for that part of the building. And what we're arguing about is, was that amount of, were those repairs necessitated by water damage, or were they necessitated because there was wear and tear, in which case it wouldn't be covered? So there's a lot of different situations where the amount of money at stake is not whether the dispute is. The dispute is whether or not the money is owed. In this case, we had both liability and damages. And you get to
for the fraudulent, the common law fraud, was that like fraud and inducement? Tell me about, when is that measured from? Like, when did the fraud occur? Let's talk about that claim. Is the fraud completed? Is what's proved when it, whatever needed to be proved up to the jury and the jury instructions? Is that fraud occurred when they took the money?
So my understanding is that, and I didn't have this case in front of the district court, so there's a limitation. I don't have perfect knowledge. I have perfect knowledge on nothing. So my understanding is that they stipulated that the date that the payments were made would be the date that the claims arose. So that fact issue, right, of when did the fraud happen?
Yeah.
That was actually removed by stipulation. They stipulated as to the dates that the claim arose. So if the date that the claim arose was the correct date for calculating prejudgment interest, then they had those dates in the stipulation.
So the stipulation, if it's under 334, they stipulated that it arise at the time of the payments.
That's what they stipulated, yes, ma'am.
Okay. So, I mean, if the fraud occurs at the time he paid and he no longer had the, you know, the benefit of having that money, why shouldn't it? I'm not quite understanding
not
why
case.
That's not ascertainable then. If it's like the fraud was done then and he gave, his money was given then, it was fraudulent, the promises that were made were fraudulent. Why? I'm not sure where once the jury decides, yeah, that's what happened, isn't it ascertainable? The defendant would know. Yeah, once I like committed fraud at that point, I should have known that I shouldn't have taken this money. I should have given it back the next day because.
So I understand the hypothetical, Your Honor. I understand the hypothetical. That's not this case.
Because
here's what actually went to the jury. This is addendum page 24. In answering questions 4 and 8, you are determined. To determine the amount of money that will fairly and adequately compensate the plaintiff for damages caused by the breach of contract. You should, et cetera, et cetera. Page 26. In deciding damages, decide the amount of money that will fairly and adequately compensate the plaintiff for the damages directly caused by relying on the defendant's misrepresentation. And then the jury's instructed. This is the difference between the actual value of what was received and the price paid for it. What was the difference between what the person paid and what they received? That was disputed. The defendants said they received some of it. We worked on the project. Some of this money was spent on the project. So he got part of what he paid for. Not all of it, but he got part of it.
So as I understand it, you're essentially saying that disputed is the same thing as whether it's readily ascertainable or not. If something is disputed, we cannot readily ascertain it.
No. I'm saying I'm following exactly what Trapp and Hoganson say. If the damages are not readily ascertainable because you have to ask the jury what they are, then they're not readily ascertainable. That's what those cases say. If the damages were readily ascertainable, then there should have been a motion for summary judgment or a motion in limine or a stipulation or something else. But Hoganson is very clear. When you ask the jury to tell us, and you say to the jury, jury, it's your job. And this here's the verdict form, right? So you've got addendum page 36. And they ask the jury, what amount of money will fairly and adequately compensate the plaintiff? Okay? What amount of money will fairly and adequately compensate the plaintiff? And it's for all the different claims. It's on addendum 38 and 39. If you answered yes, what amount of money will fairly compensate? When you say to the jury, and it says if any, right? When you say to the jury, what amount of money between zero and the 100% of the investment, what amount of that was damage? You're asking the jury to make that determination. And it's not, and to go back to your question, Your Honor, if there's a valid dispute, then yeah, it's not readily ascertainable. I mean, the whole point of the prejudgment interest, right, is to say when the defendant could figure out, right, when the defendant knows what the amount of money is, then they could pay it early and avoid the prejudgment interest, right? So if you miss your loan payment of $6,000, it's pretty obvious, right? You missed your loan payment of $6,000. That's readily ascertainable. And the faster you pay it, the less interest accrues on it. But here, the defendant did not have the ability to simply figure it out because they said, look, I spent this much money on an architect. I spent this much money on a build out. I spent this much money on a food plan, et cetera. And the jury needed to decide whether those expenditures would fit into the categories of expenditures for the Latino market before the defendant would know how much money does he need to pay back this plaintiff. So Hoganson is very clear. When the jury's asked between 0 and 100, what's the number? It's not readily ascertainable. And therefore, 549.09 applies. Thank you.
Thank you. You'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal. We'll turn next to counsel for respondent. Again, feel free to adjust the podium and please introduce yourself when you begin, and you can begin whenever you're ready.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Daniel Kennedy. I represent Ming Le Lu. With all due respect to Mr. Lindell, he did not answer some of the questions, and the obvious answer is yes, this is exactly the kind of case that you're describing, where we have stipulations as to when this money was paid. We know exactly how much was paid. We know none of it was paid back, and that amount is readily ascertainable. The question before the court is whether the trial court abused its discretion in determining that the damages to Mr. Liu were readily ascertainable employing the Hoganson standard. Mr. Lindell misspoke when he said that there was an agreement before the trial began regarding the dates where these two different interest rates would apply. That was later. The stipulation before the trial began was that the 6% rate of 344.01 would apply from the date that the payments were made. At the end of the presentation of evidence, so right before the jury was to get this case, the defendants changed their mind. They said, no, we think that 549.09 applies, and so we are going to request that the 10% interest from 549 would apply, but only from the date that the case was served, not from the date that the payments were made, which decreased the interest by hundreds of thousands of dollars. So because this earlier one had not been on the record, as the court found, this one before the trial, we made a new stipulation. And so that stipulation said, If it's 549.09, it's from the date of the lawsuit being served. But if it's 344, then we go back to when the payments were made. And so then it was up to the judge to apply that interest rate or interest rates. The facts of this case are so simple when it comes down to the analysis of whether this, whether and how this interest rate applies. The case is not highly analogous to the Blair case that's cited in the appellant's brief. It has really nothing in common with that case. That was an auto accident case where there were disputed damages. This is a case that is kind of like the insurance case that Mr. Lindell was talking about, where there were insurance checks paid to somebody, and for some reason that's the amount of damages. And a dispute arises because somebody says, well, I didn't get those checks or I didn't cash those checks. And as he describes it, it's clear that the checks were cashed. So somebody's making a claim, it may be frivolous, that, no, for some reason I don't owe the money. But the jury decides, yeah, all the money is owed, and we know exactly how much is owed because it's in the documents. So the amount of money is readily ascertainable. This case is also analogous to a situation where somebody...
So, counsel, clarify that for me.
Yeah.
How do we know, based on case law, that the amount is readily ascertainable? What's the test?
Where really no calculation has to be done. The jury doesn't have discretion to say, doesn't do any weighing, doesn't...
So that confuses me, based on my reading of the verdict form, right? And it's certainly the argument of your opposing counsel that the question of the amount, amount would fairly compensate the plaintiff, your client, was determined by the jury.
It was. Yeah. And if that's the test, then we almost never get readily ascertainable.
Right.
In fact, we wouldn't. If I were a defendant, I would immediately request a jury.
To me, the sort of, you know, off-the-cuff definition would be something like no calculation has to be done. But, I mean, the jury did do a determination of damages here.
They did. And again, if a defendant asking for a jury suddenly made it so that you could never have readily ascertainable damages, that would be a faulty standard because it would have nothing to do with the substance of the case. It would only be about procedure.
Right, if a defendant refuses to stipulate, for example, to what the damages
exactly,
are.
Or the judge refuses to stipulate. Or, in the case, the issues raised by Mr. Lindell, if there's no summary judgment, if there's no summary judgment motion, there doesn't have to be a summary judgment motion. It's not required. Why couldn't it go to the judge or the jury and have them determine it? That doesn't determine whether it's readily ascertainable or not. That's purely a procedural question. Same thing with the motions in limine. It says, well, there was no motion in limine to exclude this evidence that they say should decrease the damages. There's no requirement that you exclude irrelevant evidence. It's still irrelevant evidence to the question that the jury is determining, which is, what were the damages? The two facts that distinguish this case from really all of the other cases are, first, it's a fraud case. So it's not a situation of what were the damages later down the line. The question is, when these representations were made, fraudulent representations, and when the money was paid, how much money was paid? That is the measure of damages. That requires no calculation. This is not something where there was some offset at some later point in time. This is simply a matter of how much was lost because of these fraudulent representations. The fact that it was fraud is not disputed. That's not in front of the court, although there's ample evidence regarding that before the jury and the court. The issues before that are raised by Mr. Lindell are about this. This is in the appellant's brief at page 10. if the jury is required to determine liability and damages, then the damages are not readily ascertainable. That's not the standard. And there's no citation for that that says if it goes to the jury, then it's not readily ascertainable.
Can you help us understand then what it means when we see the word jury discretion, right? So whether something is readily ascertainable or not, and it's a question that's gone to the jury, it sounds like you're saying that sometimes when questions go to the jury, we can still determine that the amount was readily ascertainable. So help me understand how we apply, how we decide when the jury in fact exercised discretion and when they did not.
Some of the cases that are cited did go to a jury. And so the cases talk about the jury deciding and how the jury may have calculated, but it really makes no difference whether it's the judge or the jury. The judge could have had these same facts. It could have been a court trial, and it could have been the judge saying, well, this is how much you paid, and this is how much you lost. They're the same.
I think the argument is more the fact finder has to exercise discretion so it's not readily ascertainable. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure it's a jury judge thing. It's whether facts have to be. So if we look, for example, you know, quoting from Trapp, damages are readily ascertainable when the amount demanded can be ascertained by computation or reference to generally recognized standards and does not depend on a contingency. Or from Hogenson, it talks about they're ascertainable when they're not ascertainable when they depend on contingencies or jury discretion. Like I could imagine, maybe I'm wrong, but pain and suffering might be something that is not readily ascertainable. I don't know. I don't know if there's a case that deals with pain and suffering damages, whether a defendant should know what that amount is at, you know, early.
Right.
But I'm just, you know, where in the types of cases we're talking about, and specifically I think what the argument here is, well, even with the fraud, you know, you made a representation, got a payment in reliance on that representation. But we did do some of it, and the jury had to decide, did you do some of it? How much were you actually damaged in your reliance on that statement? Is right. that a discretionary act by the jury?
So I agree with you 100%. It is irrelevant who decides. It's the finder of fact, whether it's the court of the trial. And that really is not the appellant's argument. They say if it's a jury issue, it doesn't matter. And there are thousands of cases every year, of course, where the finder of fact has discretion to determine and weigh the evidence to say how much is pain and suffering worth, or was this insurance check supposed to cover damage from the storm, or was it something that was ordinary wear and tear that had to be fixed anyway? So there are lots of times when the jury could make a decision like that. The question here was not that kind of a question. It was simply, how much did my client pay? There is no dispute that my client got nothing out of it. Nothing was paid back to my client. My client did not get the store, the investment opportunity that he was looking for. I'll note that the evidence at trial was that this money was supposed to be held until all of the money was in, and all of the money wasn't supposed to be in until the visa was approved. That never got done because Mr. Sabree was in charge of that and didn't fulfill that. So it really goes back to this investment time. There's no contingency that could be employed here. There's simply none. There's no weighing of anything. All of the work that Mr. Sabree claims that he did were improvements to his building, which, by the way, he leased to somebody else. So he had an initial lease that he showed my client saying, yes, you have a lease for Latino Market LLC. But then he leased the space to somebody else without telling Mr. Liu. He leased it to a child care center, which is still there today. There's nothing in it that Mr. Sabree did that was actually for Mr. Liu. He may have done some things that were to encourage Mr. Liu to pay more money. He did file some articles of incorporation, organization for the LLC. And he got a business plan that he showed to Mr. Liu saying, look, we're on track. He got a lease that doesn't cost him any money, but got a lease saying, look, we have a space in his own building. And Mr. Liu paid more money. That's not something that Mr. Liu actually benefited from. That was just an expense of what we call a fundraising expense. Money you have to pay to get money by Mr. Sabri. In the end, all of that was was not anything that Mr. Liu benefited from. So there's no calculation to say, you know, how much did he pay and how much did he get back? There's nothing there. So it's just the money that he paid.
What is our standard of review? Is the district court, in deciding that the damages are readily ascertainable, is that a factual finding by the district court that's owed some deference?
I believe so. I think it's a abuse of discretion standard.
Abuse of discretion. Or maybe it's factual. Is it clearly erroneous? Or what should we look at? What case tells us what the abuse of, or what the standard of review is of that determination?
I'm sorry, I don't have a case on that.
Do you agree with opposing counsel that our analysis is governed primarily by the Hoganson case, or would you have us look at something else?
I think the Hoganson case is really the standard setter for that hasn't been overruled, and no other case has come that.
And does it answer all the questions? I mean, I guess in part I'm wondering whether this case poses some interesting fact and or law, legal issues that suggest that it should be released as a precedential opinion. I don't know if you've given some thought to that.
I've done a number of these, and I don't think I've ever gotten a precedential opinion. So I never really considered that issue. I think it could be clarified in this case. This issue of the finder of fact that we just discussed about whether it has to be a jury issue, because that's certainly their argument. I think that clarifying what the finder of facts, what is required of the finding of fact would be helpful to say in a case like this, there is no contingency, there's no discretion that leads somebody to think, oh, we shouldn't apply it in this rate. And it's also helpful to have the combination of the two statutes and say how they interact, because we're using the Hoganson case for that, but there's really very little case law on that subject. So clarifying that a bit, I think, would be helpful.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honors.
All right, and your time is up. And we will turn back to counsel for appellant. We'll have 5 minutes on the clock, and you can begin when you are ready.
Thank you. So that was, it's not in any way, shape, or form accurate to say that there was no dispute, that the jury didn't weigh anything. If there was no dispute and the jury didn't weigh anything, then I would agree. That's absolutely false. The cites are in the record. The evidence was put in. The jury weighed the evidence, and they rejected the defense. The district court acknowledged in her order at addendum page 9, although defendants put on a defense that they used some of the funds appropriately, the district court said, the jury wholly rejected that defense. That's right. That's what happened. This is, in hindsight, what you're hearing is an argument that says, see, we knew this was a load of stuff the whole time. We always knew this was a frivolous defense. Well, no, you didn't. It went to trial. If you're worried about which interest statute is going to apply, then figure out if the damages are readily ascertainable or not and get them fixed. Figure it out. The question of whether these things were readily ascertainable, et cetera, all that could have gone to the jury, but no, there was a stipulation. The jury was asked to decide, not was there fraud, yes or no, because we know what the damages are. Was there breach of contract, yes or no, because we know what the damages are. The jury was asked to decide how much of the money was used for Latino Market and therefore wasn't damages. They were asked, was any of this money used for Latino Market? If Because there's a difference between the total amount of money invested and the amount of the fraud. And we had this argument about, oh, the fraud happens at the time of the lie. No. The jury was instructed. The fraud damages are the difference in value between what was paid for and what was received. Now, what was arguably received over time were the steps that were made by for the Latino market. Now, the jury decided that they didn't agree with that. They didn't believe the testimony. They didn't believe the evidence. They didn't buy it. They said that's not stuff that we feel was part of the Latino market. So we're not going to give you an offset.
So I have a question for you about jury discretion. Is there a distinction between the jury exercising discretion with respect to the amount, the actual amount that might be awarded, versus whether the amount is owed at all or not? And I'm thinking of the way you've described this in terms of, like, here's a payment, here's these 10 payments, we have a ledger of these 10 payments. And if the jury just has to say, yes, we think that was paid and used for the right thing versus it wasn't, and that's what dictates which category it goes into, is that different from a situation similar to what Judge Smith was talking about, where they're being asked to say, how much is this worth? There's no monetary amount that we can line it up to with on a sheet. So is the discretion that's being exercised in that situation somehow qualitatively different that changes whether we get to whether it's readily ascertainable or not?
No. That's the Blair case. That's a fantastic example. I was going to bring that up. So your question makes me extremely happy. So in Blair, you had this dispute over medical bills, right? So the bills, they exist. They are what they are. The dispute was over how many of these had to be paid for. So if it was in, then it's part of the damages. If it's out, it's not part of the damages. The jury had to decide what was in, what was out. So the total potential amount was fixed, and the jury had to decide, of that total potential amount, which bills are in and which bills are out. All fixed. 549.09. Because why? Because it's not readily ascertainable, because there was a dispute over which bills were in and which bills were out, and the dispute went to the jury. And we've had an agreement here that Hoganson controls. And there's this, like, we're getting really deep into hypotheticals when Hoganson is very, very simple. Right? Hoganson, page 274, here's the quote. In this case, the purpose of the trial was to determine the amount of damages Arthur incurred as a result of the conversion of his stock and property. Thus, the damages were not liquidated nor readily ascertainable. Accordingly, 549. It's that simple. If you're worried about what interest is going to apply, then figure out if the damages are readily ascertainable or not and get it nailed down. No, you don't have to move for summary judgment, but if you go and you ask the jury what number between 0 and 100% are the damages, and the jury has to weigh the evidence, which opposing counsel agrees is exactly what happened, and you can't disagree because the district court talked about it. The district court said the jury rejected the defense. The jury had to weigh the evidence and make a decision.
The district court also says, though, the jury did no calculation to adjust the amount of the award.
That's right.
Basically, the jury accepted the testimony of the plaintiff.
Correct. The jury did. The jury right. made a determination. Until the jury
made
that determination.
I guess what I'm getting back to is this question that Judge Smith asked about what is our standard of review, because apparently determining what is readily ascertainable under the case law, I think, is a question of fact, right?
So it is.
And it was in this particular case given to the district court, so aren't we really just asking that question, whether the record supports the district court's determination that in this particular case, fact specific, these damages were readily ascertainable because the jury simply accepted the plaintiff's testimony.
No, I completely disagree. The standard of review.
Disagree with what? The standard of review?
No, ma'am.
Okay, all right.
The standard of review is whether the district court's finding here was manifestly contrary to the weight of the evidence or not reasonably supported by the evidence as a whole. And the evidence as a whole, the question, the fact question about whether it was readily ascertainable here, the fact question is, did the jury have to make a decision and weigh the evidence? If the jury had to weigh the evidence and make a decision, it's not readily ascertainable. That's what Hoganson tells us. Not hindsight. Hey, okay. The jury decided that this was all a bunch of bunk.
And your time has expired.
Thank you, Your Honor.
But thank you. Thank you to both counsel for your argument here today, as well as for the briefing on the case. We certainly appreciate the effort, and the case is submitted. We will issue a decision in the statutory timeframe. Thank you.